redemptive. All right, Proverbs. Let's start there. Man, I'm getting old. Like, I could not remember for the life of me where we left off. I'm like, I think we're in the book of Numbers. I think. So, I think I've whittled it down to a few chapters. So, if I start talking and this all sounds familiar, just give me one of these. Or slow down. We haven't gotten to it yet. So, all right, Proverbs 25:20. I think we have not done this one yet. But then again, who knows? 25:20. Someone read that when you get there. Yep. All right. Odd sounding proverb, but the message is loud and clear. Like one who takes off a garment on a cold day. So who walks outside and says, boy, it's 30 degrees outside. I'm going to go ahead and take my sweatshirt off. Stupid people do that, right? Because it's just, that's dumb. Okay. You don't do that. Or like vinegar on soda. This one's probably not quite as familiar to you, but you remember it. Do you guys remember in like seventh grade biology class when you guys all had your science fair project due and there was always one kid in the class that made the volcano, right? The two things that you put in the volcano to make it explode were vinegar and soda. It causes an explosive reaction, more or less, and then it renders everything useless at the end, right? So it's an acidic compound and alkaline. You put them together, it's explosive, but at the end of it all, you get a whole bunch of nothing, okay? So someone who sings songs to a troubled heart is both part A, stupid, like one who takes off their garment on a cold day, and causes something, a reaction that's explosive and then ultimately renders both people kind of useless. What does it mean to sing songs to a troubled heart? What type of situation is this individual in, this person that's being spoken of in this proverb? What does it mean that they have a troubled heart? They're sad. I mean, they're sad. They're having a rough day for whatever reason, okay? And how is this person's reaction? How is our reaction when we go in there? What do? Sing song. What does that mean? What does that person need in that moment? Sympathy. Someone to be sympathetic, to listen, right? What is this person doing instead? Something that's stupid and explosive. They're singing songs to them, meaning it's the wrong response, right? It's not what that person needs in that time. You're seeing the situation completely wrong because you're not paying attention. You're not listening. You're doing what you want to do and don't have any idea what this person's going through. So instead of listening and being sympathetic to what's happening around you, you take off your garment, you put soda on vinegar, and you cause this explosive reaction. So this person who is desperately just in need of someone to sit with them, to listen to them, and just be with them, instead gets advice or whatever. And what does that cause within that person? Does it make their situation better? No, it causes them to explode in anger and frustration, and it ultimately is a useless situation. For those of you guys that have plans to go into any type of career that you're going to deal with people, right? Be it law enforcement, nursing, counseling, pastoring, any time that you're going to have interactions with people at a level that's like below a one, you're going to need to be aware of this. Just that idea of being sympathetic and able to deal with other human beings on their level and what they're going through. One of the quickest things that happens to people that spend a lot of time in kind of the vortex of ministry or the vortex of people's pain is they get very unsympathetic. They get jaded and they get very frustrated at humanity and the things that are happening around them. And as a result, they want to be away from it. They want to distance themselves. So they don't enter in. They won't go there. They won't be sympathetic because they don't want to because it hurts too much, right? I get a buddy of mine that's a paramedic, and he is probably the most jaded individual I've ever met. And then you listen to him talk about his job, and you're like, man, I think I'd be pretty jaded as well. Like, he's going to pick up the same person for the ninth time that has a cold and calls 911 and takes a $10,000 ambulance ride to the hospital because they have no other way to get to the hospital, so they call 911. And at some point, he's just like, man, I'm so frustrated with these people that just don't know how to, whatever. And it becomes those people versus me and gets jaded and frustrated. And he kind of has that attitude about life and such. So if you're going to go down those roads in terms of your career, some of us have much better natural listening and empathy skills than others. I certainly do not put myself in that boat. Okay, I listen poorly and empathize even worse. Kids were laughing last night. My wife was talking about somehow, welcome to our home, talking about estrogen and progesterone and testosterone, right? This is the conversation we're having with my all of our families in our bathrooms. I'm trying to go to sleep. Welcome to my world, right? And they're talking about what estrogen does versus testosterone. And my youngest daughter says, my wife has just explained now progesterone and estrogen, and these are women's hormones, and men don't have those. And my youngest daughter, Ella, says, Daddy, or says, Mommy, what's testosterone? And my wife says, that's what makes Daddy have no feelings. Now I'm going to bed. So she said that obviously tongue in cheek. But I do not excel in those areas. Some of you are super gifted with this because of your personalities, your harmonizers, you can enter in, you feel deeply, you can empathize with people. That is a wonderful, wonderful quality. Okay. Be careful as you head down those roads that you don't let that get you jaded when you're dealing with difficulty. Okay. And that's it will happen throughout life. Okay. So be aware of that. Be sympathetic. Okay. What type of high priest, by the way, is Jesus called in the book of Hebrews? A sympathetic high priest, right? Who understands where we are, understands our pain and our difficulties, our sin patterns and those things, right? We're commanded in 1 Peter to be sympathetic to other people around us, okay? So it's a quality that's not just exalted here in our Old Testament, obviously in our New Testament as well, okay? Thoughts on that? You unsympathetic people that don't ask questions. All right. Let's go to numbers, shall we? Somebody that has some sympathy. 13? Sweet. I was right. So we finished 12? It's a problem when you study, because you study ahead and then you don't get there and you're like, did I have that conversation with myself at my desk or publicly with them? I really don't remember. All right. Anna, will you pray for us? Speaking of your great sympathy. No? You out? You don't have to. I'm not going to arm wrestle you. You're just being unsympathetic and rude if you don't, but feel free not to.
My prayer. I pray for all of us, and I just pray that we would listen to your Holy Spirit and that these words would transform us and they wouldn't just be knowledge. I pray for every single one of these individuals as they enter after this into their day, and I pray that you would just be with them and they would feel you. In Jesus' name.
Amen. All right, so as we're talking through this portion now, obviously in Numbers 13, thank you again for the reminder, this section is all kind of leading to a climax, right? And it starts really in chapter 11. Now that the nation of Israel has been sitting again at the foot of Mount Sinai for about a year since Exodus chapter 19, in chapter 11 we see them begin to move for the first time, or really 1 through 10. And then 11 we see kind of the beginnings of some murmurings, that underground kind of grumbling about life, right? And we talked about where it started from. Where did the barking about their situation begin? The outside, right? And who do we define that as, more than likely?
Outsiders.
Yeah, probably the Egyptians, probably the hanger-oners, the guys that saw the cool magic show, right? Wow, God, all these plagues that you brought were awesome, and how you defeated Egypt and got your people out and cross the Red Sea. This is great. So I'm kind of in it for, you know, the fun stuff. So they're here, and now life's getting hard. God's kind of ramping up the difficulty, and it's starting to get difficult. So in 11, we saw that begin to go. We saw God provide what they wanted, which was meat, and basically says, listen, you want some meat? I'm going to make the meat come out your ears, provides quail for them for a month, and then that is kind of a plague, ultimately, that they experience. Chapter 12, then, we saw the circle kind of continue to move inward, right? It affected not just the outsides, but you saw the people. The Israelites begin to grumble as well in chapter 11. And now it's moving in all the way to chapter 12. We see Miriam and Aaron, okay, begin to bark at Moses. And they bring this issue of, hey, we don't like the Canaanite woman that you married, or the Cushite woman, rather, in verse 12, or, chapter 12, verse 1. But we see that the real issue is, hey, who's in charge here? We used to do all these really cool things, and now you're kind of the guy. And God basically says, hey, you should know better than to speak to Moses like that. I speak to him not in dreams and revelations, but I speak to him face to face. And you should know that he is the guy, not because he exalted himself, but he's the guy that I put there to lead these people. So we're seeing kind of that inward circle continue to move in, all right? Now, in chapter 13, this is a bit of a parenthesis from the story. We're going to see now God send out spies to go into the land, okay? This is all, for those of you that grew up in church and have been a part of Sunday school, right? You've heard this story, the 12 spies that go into the land, bring back evidence of the fruit of the land, literally, and show the people how great the land is that God's calling them to go to. So chapter 13, we're going to see that story, and then we'll continue kind of with the story of the grumbling as it moves inward to the circle. Okay, so let's pick up chapter 13, verse 1.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. For each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them."
All right, so God commands the people, send spies, right? Does God not know what's in the land? Why would he be doing this? Who's this for? The people, right? For what purpose is that? What would it do for the people? Have they ever been to the land? No? They've heard stories about it from God. Hey, it's great. You're going to love it, right? Well, how do we know? How would they know? Man, here's fruit. Here's a grape that's as big as a watermelon, right? It's amazing. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. It's legit. Here's what we've seen. So God is giving them a sense of, hey, where I'm taking you is real. The promises that I've made you, you can touch and feel and see with your eyes. So he's giving them some sense of security or confirmation that this is indeed a great place. Okay, in verses 4 through 16, you see the guys called from every tribe. Okay, most of them are forgettable because they all sin at the end of it, as you guys know. But two guys stand out in the midst of this story that we'll hear about in a minute. The first one is in verse 6, Caleb, who is from the tribe of Judah. And in verse 8, you see a guy named Hoshea, okay? In verse 16, we see that this is Moses' boy. Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So Joshua and Caleb are two of the 12 spies that get sent out. Nobody from Levi, by the way, is sent, right? So you've got 13 tribes, but Levi stays home because they're doing the work of the priesthood. Those guys go, right? From the tribe of Judah, Caleb, and then Joshua from Ephraim. So remember those tribes down the road. So those are the guys that get sent out. And let's pick up in their story in verse 17.
Then Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, "Go up this way into the south, go up into the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell there are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, whether there are forests there or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land." Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes.
All right, so Moses gives them these commands. Check out these things. Why else would this be a great idea? What are they about to do when they enter the land, aside from just enjoy its bounty? What do they have to do first? They got to fight. They got to clear everybody out. So any good general is going to say, man, we need to know what we're up against, right? What are we dealing with here? Let's go scout out the land so that we can form a plan so we know what we're doing. And they're going to find out pretty quickly, there ain't nothing you can do. You're outnumbered. They're all bigger and stronger and tougher than you are. They have better military warfare, you know, equipment than you do. You've got like plowshares and a bunch of nothing. So take your Kaflon pans and you're going to go to battle with those. That's basically what they have. So it's good and bad in terms of it's supposed to ramp up their faith. We'll see how they respond to this in a bit, right? So it's in the time of the harvest, so obviously the grapes are in a great spot. And notice basically how quickly they get there. They are in kind of the southern portion of the land. They're in just south of the Negev, right? The bottom of of Israel, in a place called Kadesh Barnea. We'll see that mentioned a few times, and this is going to be kind of their home base as they're going to launch now north into the land. And it doesn't take them long to get there, right? They are not, they're going to wander obviously for 40 years. We know the rest of the story, but they get in and out pretty quick. They're there for 40 days, but they go all the way north, basically up towards Jerusalem to Hebron. They go spy out a bunch of cities. They see all this. It's not a difficult journey per se. God just doesn't choose to let them in, okay? Verse 25, we get kind of the report as they come back from their travels. When they return from spying out the land, the end of 40 days, they proceeded to tell Moses and Aaron all that the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran, in Kadesh, or Kadesh Barnea, that's where they are located now, the rest of the community, they brought back word to them to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So they get what Moses asked for, show us the bounty of the land, and tell us about the condition of the land. Somebody pick up in 27, and let's hear the report.
Certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit.
All right, so what do they say to begin with?
Did what we said,
and it's all God said it was. It certainly does flow with milk and honey. It's a great land. Here's the fruit. It's awesome. However, 28.
Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the city cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there.
All right, so we'll find out about more of who those guys are in a minute. Okay, so upside is land's great. The downside is what?
Can't get there.
Dude, it's we can get in there, but what can we not do? How many battles are we going to win? Exactly zero. They're fortified cities. They're very large. The descendants of Anak are there. We'll find out about them here again in a minute. Read verse 33. This is the Anakim, or the sons of Anak.
There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight.
You guys remember that term, the Nephilim or the Nephilim we talked about in Genesis chapter 6? Who are they? We haven't heard about them in a long time. The sons of God inhabited the daughters of men, and they created like Shaquille O'Neal, Superman, right? These are the giants that God, prior to the flood, led him to destroy the earth. And apparently there's some type of connection between, at least visually, they saw the people of the land and said, dude, that's like Shaquille O'Neal's like second cousin. He's gigantic. So somehow they say the Anak, or the sons of Anak, the Anakim, are related to the Nephilim. They're giants. And we're going to find out. They're not lying. When they go to battle and they talk about the size of these people, we're going to get a description. They're not messing around. They're giant people. So there are a line of really, really big dudes in the land. Obviously, we know that when we move forward with Goliath and we see him described as David goes to battle with him way in the future. This is legit. So they are up against fortified cities. They're outmatched. They're outnumbered. Everything about the situation is terrible. Like if you're trying to implement battle and what have you. Okay, so it's an honest report. The problem is they say in verse 28, people are strong. Verse 29, Amalek is living in the land, and the Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, and the hill country are living in the land. And then verse 30 now, knowing that the people are beginning to get discouraged, watch who steps up.
Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it.
This guy, I like this guy, right? He's looking at the odds and going, but God's on our side, right? We can do this. He's called us to do this. Even though the situation looks bleak, we should go. God's told us to go. He's promised us this land now for hundreds of years. We should go. So he looks at fear and says, man, yes, I'm as scared as everybody else, but we're going to go and we're going to do this. So this guy, Caleb, steps up. The problem is everybody else, verse 31.
But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us.
Is that correct? Absolutely, it's correct. You know, minus God out of the equation, you're hosed. They're too big, they're too strong, we can't. So keep reading verse 32.
So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size.
So what is the advice of the other 10 spies? No, we're going to, we need a plan B. This is not good. So what's our problem at this point? If you've been wandering in the wilderness now for a year, and you've been dealing with lack of food and lack of water and the heat and the exhaustion, you're already kind of ticked at Moses, right? Because he's kind of failed to do what you've expected him to do numerous times now. And then the land that you're finally been promised for all these years, and that has been your one solitary hope, right? What just happened? How are you feeling right now as a mom and dad or a kid in the wilderness at this point? We're hopeless. We have nowhere to go. We can't go back from where we came from. We were slaves there. Can't go there. We can't stay here because it's horrible. We have no food. We have no water, right? If God doesn't provide for us, this is horrible. So you can feel the frustration and the tension of the people arising. This is the advice, right? But what does God want them to do? Clearly, go into the land. I told you to go in. Go do battle in the land. I'll take care of you, okay? But the report of the spies is no, we're not going to go. So they give, obviously, this horrible report, except for Caleb, who's specifically mentioned. Joshua is assumed in that as well. Okay, so he is on board with Caleb's advice. So, bad report. So that's chapter 13. This is the advice of the spies that go out in the land. In chapter 14 now, we're going to see how the congregation responds to said report. 14 verse 1, let's pick up there.
Children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, And the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness, why has the Lord brought us up to the land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should become victims?
Now, it sounds better when you read it like this, by the way. Why? Right. But I look at them and I laugh until you go to this land and you realize what they're in. Like, how would you respond honestly? Like, if this was the report that you got, this is exactly how I respond. Moses, I hate you. This is horrible. We're all going to die. Why did you even take us out here? Why didn't you just leave us? It was better being a slave when we had pots of meat to eat. And yeah, the labor stunk, but at least we had food and protection and could lay our head down at night, get a solid 8 hours. This is horrible. So you get a very honest response from them. And again, I gave these guys such a bad time until you realize they're completely hopeless at this point. And that's how they respond. And it is a very true response. Now, the problem is what they're going to suggest next in verse 4.
So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt.
Ooh. So what's there now? What's the new plan? Let's impeach Moses, right? And we'll get a new guy, a new gal, a new somebody. We don't care as long as they're going to help us do a 180 and go home, basically is their deal, okay? Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation, and Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh and those who had spied out the land tore their clothes, and they spoke to the congregation in verse 7 and said, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If, verse 8, the Lord is pleased with us, will he then bring us into this land and give it to us, a land flowing with milk and honey? Like, if we're walking in obedience, and if we do what God asks us to do, will he not indeed take care of us? That is the response of these people. They're not saying, hey, the cities aren't fortified or the people aren't big. They're saying, yes, all that's true. However, trust God, walk with him, let's live in obedience, let's see what happens, okay? Verse 9, here's the only way that we can implode as a community. Read that. All the congregation now in verse 10 says, let's stone them with stones. So they try, Moses and Aaron, Joshua and Caleb try to rally the people, give them this great hoorah halftime speech. You know, yeah, it looks bleak and we're losing 75-0, but hey, we can come back in the second half, right? They try to rally them, and what is their response in verse 10? Like, ooh, this is a whole nother level of bad for Moses. I mean, they're barking at him before. You can feel the leadership burden that he's felt in the past. Where are they at with Moses now? We're going to kill you. Like, this is bad, yes? It doesn't get any worse than let's kill you. First, we're going to appoint a new leader. You could quietly just sit down, Moses, and, you know, we could impeach you. But now we're going to assassinate you, and then you're going to be forced to not be our guy anymore. So this is bleak. It is horrible. And what's going on within the hearts of the people right now? On a spiritual level.
Lots of sin.
Yeah, right? A ton of sin. What else?
Probably not trusting God.
Totally, right? They're jacked. There's no trust with them. They see with their eyes a horrible situation, and that's all that they can perceive. Nothing outside of that. No God in the picture. And right now, there's like four people in Israel that go, yes, we can still do this. God is still able. Rally, right? And they just won't. They suggest, let's kill Moses, okay? End of verse 10, the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. So now God's going to show up in the midst of this dialogue. And watch what he says in verse 11.
The Lord said to Moses, how long will these people despise me, and how long will they not believe in me, in spite of all the signs that I have done among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they.
That's a pretty fair assertion, right? God showed them 10 plagues where he defeated every one of Israel's gods. He crossed the Red Sea, opened up the Red Sea. They crossed on dry ground. And then he's provided for them food and water. As you start numbering all the things that they needed and everything that they've experienced at this point, it's like another 10 miracles that he's done in the desert. He's like, what else do you want me to do? What can I show you that will demonstrate my power that will in turn cause you to respond in faith? It's a very fair question. Is there anything else God can do? Like, would the 25th miracle really get them there? I mean, at this point, you realize They're hard hearts. They're just hard. Nothing's going to change it, right? And I think I've talked about this in here before, but we always have this sense if we could see God move visually, if we could see some type of external sign from God, right? A plane in the sky that told me God's will, that wrote it in smoke, you know, Mike, do this today, or an email, or a God speaking audibly to me, that somehow my hard heart would become soft. It's just not the case, gang. This is the congregation that saw more miracles than any other civilization on the face of the earth ever. They are the hardest hearted generation that's ever lived. It's insane. So even though they saw the visible hand of God move in more tangible and real ways than anybody else, it did nothing for their hearts. So don't be deceived into thinking that somehow some previous congregation had it better, or in certain times when other people got to see miracles, they had it better. We have the Holy Spirit, and that is eons, eons better than what these people had, because they're asking for, again, another sign, and we see it. It just won't work. They're at 20-plus miracles that God has done, and their hearts are hard, okay? So God's response is what? Reset button, okay? We've heard this before. Let's kill them all, okay? They're going to be hard-hearted and not believe, then fine. If that's what they want, let them go back to Egypt. Let them die in the wilderness. I will start over, and I will raise up another group of people that ultimately will demonstrate obedience. And again, I think this is a test for Moses. And let's see how he responds in verse 13. Wow. So again, we've seen Moses do this before, but what is he saying? Whose reputation is at stake? God's, not mine. Like, look, I'm just your guy. It has nothing to do with me. Your reputation is at stake, God. If you don't do this, you're going to be the laughingstock of all the nations. I mean, what a brilliant response to Moses. Now remember, there are people literally coming into his camp with large rocks saying, I want to stone you. How? Moses' response is unbelievable to me. This guy has got godliness to the core. He's got perspective. He and three other people are the only people in the congregations that say, yeah, we're on God's team, right? He is outnumbered. I have such an admiration for the focus and the godliness that he has and the perspective in this moment to not make it about himself, to not walk in fear, to not say, like, what would you do if God said, all these people that are coming to kill you right now, how about I kill them all? What would your response be? Absolutely, how about right now? Right? I mean, he's fearful for his life at this point. It's legit. This isn't just a suggestion. They're going to kill him. So, rough spot. But Moses says, no, I pray now. Verse 17, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you've declared. God is slow to anger. He quotes Exodus 34 to God, back to God, God's own autobiography about his personhood and who he is as an individual. He quotes it back to him and says, God, you are gracious. You're compassionate. You are... will indeed display wrath when necessary, but, verse 19, pardon the iniquity of this people, forgive them. Yes, they're insolent. Yes, they're disobedient, but forgive them nonetheless. That's what Moses ultimately asks, and God says in verse 20, read that. All right, so what's God's response? Does he forgive them? Yeah, but is there a consequence to their disobedience? Yeah, and what is it? You're done. You're going to die here in the wilderness. You're not getting to go into the land, right? I will forgive you, but you do not get to go into the land. You see that in verse 22 mention, have put me to the test these 10 times. That literally could be, again, as you trace back the miracles of food and water and all the things that God's provided, it seems to be close to 10, or it could just be a, all these times that I have provided it, okay? But regardless, they have seen a ton, and God says they should know better. Their response should be different. I will forgive them, but there is a consequence to their disobedience. They do not get to go in, okay? Specifically, all the men, and we're going to see that it's anybody over the age of 20 years old. We see that in verse 29. from 20 years age and up, all who have grumbled against me do not get to go into the land. And God is basically saying, anybody who has seen the 10 plagues, the Red Sea crossing, and all my provision, that not just has seen it, but has experienced it, and that is accountable for it, you do not get to go into the land. So if you were 7 and you were part of this, God's like, no, that you're not, this doesn't fall on you, this falls on your parents, okay? So everybody that's 40 years age and upward does not get to go in the land. The exceptions are obviously Moses, Aaron, Miriam, well, we'll see what happens to them, but they're excluded in that sense, and the two other spies, obviously, that we saw bring back a good report. Verse 24, Caleb, watch what God says about this guy in verse 24. Tell me you wouldn't want this written on your tombstone. So Caleb, because he has followed me fully, right? What a great description of who this guy is. So Caleb in verse 24, and then verse 30, we see Caleb mentioned again, and end of verse 30, Joshua, the son of Nun. So both those guys are excluded from the curse that's about to take place, okay? Now, 31 and following, keep reading there, Cass. So we're going to spend the next 40 years, 37 and a half years to be exact, killing off the old generation. You're all going to die, okay? Keep going in 33 and 4.
And your children shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years and shall suffer for your faithlessness until the last of your dead bodies lie in the wilderness. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, a year for each day, you shall bear your iniquity 40 years and you shall know my displeasure.
Ouch. So for every day the spies were gone, they pay it back in a year for their disobedience. Now, think about just these numbers for a second. This is insane if you really start breaking it down. So if we've got 1.2 million adults over the age of 20, right? That's the old generation that came out. So 600,000 men, 600,000 women, okay? They've got about 37 and a half years left of this 40 years. They're getting credit for time served, if you will. That would equal out to about 32,000 people a year that have to die, okay? That is 87 people a day. That's 3.65 people an hour that would die if they died on a 24-hour basis, like on a consistent rotation, okay? If they only died during waking hours, you're basically having 7 funerals an hour for 40 years. You have a death every 8.5 minutes. 40 years from 6 in the morning to 6 at night every 8.5 minutes. Is that not insane? Now, what's the problem, by the way, with that? As we've read in the law, when you have that much death, what is that going to cause for the congregation? Everybody's going to be unclean, right? You're going to see God's going to have to make like an exception in the law as to how to deal with this issue. We'll see that coming up in Numbers 19, I think it is, where God creates like a giant basin of holy water, more or less. I think that's where the idea came from. Here, to deal with the amount of uncleanliness that there would be in every household all the time, okay? So, one death every 8.5 minutes for 40 years as we kill off this old generation. Insane. So they're paying for their disobedience and their lack of faith as a result of this response. So God has forgiven them, but he's done. He is officially done with them, okay? Let's see. Let's watch now how the people respond, verse 39.
Then Moses said these words to all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly. And they rose early in the morning and went up to the top of the mountain, saying, here we are, and we dwell. We will go up to the place which the Lord has promised to be up to the sin.
So, wait, hold on real quick. So what happens to the people? What do you see in them? Here we are, we have indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised. Where's the place which the Lord has promised?
Land.
The land. They're going to go to the land, okay? So what do they say prior to that? We have sinned. What is that? It's a confession, right? So why are they confessing at this point?
They don't want to spend 40 years in the desert.
Yeah, because their consequences suck, right? I mean, basically. Are their hearts really changed? No, right? They've been given time after time after time to repent, and what do? They don't repent. What do they want? Give me food. Give me water. Give me shelter. I don't like manna anymore. I want quail. Right? All they do is bark and complain. And then finally God steps up, and what happens? He makes consequences for their sin. They don't care about their sin. What do they care about? I care about the consequences. Now I'm going to repent. We've talked about this again before, but this is a great measuring rod for all of us when we're in sin, right? Are we more concerned that we violated the heart and will of God, or are we more concerned that now we're having to deal with the consequences of our own sin? Which one leads us to repentance? And sometimes God will use that, right? That paddle on my butt sometimes led me to repent as a kid, right? Because I needed consequences to remember in the future, wow, that hurt. That was not fun. Being grounded in whatever was unpleasant. I don't want to do that again. The higher level is, boy, I violated my relationship with God. I've broken trust with Him. I've broken that, and I need to reestablish that. And that grieves me more than any consequence that God could give me, because I have interfered with that relationship. He's still my Father. I'm still His Son. That hasn't changed, but He is grieved over my decision. Does that make sense? And that's, these people don't have that. They have hardened hearts, and they only care about what they can taste, touch, and feel. And that's ultimately how they respond. So they say, we're going to go into the land to show you, Moses, that we've really repented. Here's Moses' response in verse 41 and 2.
But Moses said, why now are you transgressing the command of the Lord? And that will not succeed. Do not go up, for the Lord is not among you, lest you be struck down before your enemies.
So what does Moses say? This is stupid. This is a bad idea. Y'all don't want to do this. God is not with you. And of course, they always listen to Moses, so they clearly repent, right? So they don't. They say, the heck with you. Verse 43, the Amalekites, the Canaanites will be there. You're going to fall by the sword. You're all going to die. Okay, if that's what you want. That's what's going to happen. The Lord will not, verse 43, be with you. Verse 44, they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant nor the Lord of the Lord nor Moses left the camp. So all these people leave. Moses is there. God is clearly there because they can see Him in the Shekinah glory in the cloud. But they all go to battle heedlessly against Moses' advice. Verse 45, what happens? Hormah is next to like Beersheba, so the southern portion of the land. They go up all the way into like Hebron, the hill country. I mean, they're in kind of the, over by Jerusalem, like the southern portion of the land. They just go straight through from the south, from Kadesh Barnea, and march right into the land. And they get spanked, just like God says. And they come home with their tail between their legs because God wasn't with them. Moses wasn't with them. And exactly what Moses had promised happens. You are not going to go in. God said no. You're going heedlessly, and now they're going to pay the consequences of that. So they beat them back as far as Hormah, and they come home back to Kadesh Barnea realizing we're done. So rough response. So we're seeing again this tension continue to rise, and it's not over yet, right? The people refuse to take responsibility for their actions. This is not their fault, right? This is Moses' fault. It's God's fault. It's somebody else's fault. And in verse chapter 15 and 16, we're going to continue to see that reestablished, okay? 15 is like an aside, if you will. 16 is where this story of grumbling will continue. 15 is a bit of a parenthesis as well, similar to the spying out of the land. God basically in 15 goes through all these laws again, okay? He walks through offerings and all the stuff that the people were to offer, goes through burnt offerings and all this stuff. I mean, all the way through chapter 15, that's all he's talking about. Why would God now suddenly start reviewing offerings again? Didn't we cover that for like forever in the book of Leviticus? It's pretty clear. He did like 7 chapters on that, and then he did like highlights throughout. Why would God spend time saying, right now, let's talk about offerings again? Who's God thinking about at this point? The children. The children, right? Now I have to teach the younger generation. They have to own this. These instructions were given to the adults, and they applied to everybody. But God is now going to reestablish His covenant with them. And again, that's the book of Deuteronomy where we're going to go next. That's all they're talking about. It's a reestablishing of God's covenant. And God's reminding them, hey, this promise wasn't just for me and your parents. This promise was for me and you. This applies to you. You own this and your kids. This is everybody. So 15, He reestablishes this idea of offerings and all the stuff that's going to happen. He tells them what's going to happen when they enter the land. Look at verse 17. By the way, verses basically 1 through 15 are what's going to happen when they get into the land. He tells them all these sacrifices that they're to do when they get into the land. And in verse 18 and 19, here's why they're offering those sacrifices.
Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land to which I bring you, and when you eat of the bread of the land, you shall present a contribution to the Lord.
So what are they eating when they get into the land? Bread. From where?
From
the land. What have they been eating for the last 40 years? So what's about to stop? Manna. God's going to stop his provision when they get into the land, and they're going to eat what? The produce of the land that they didn't work for, they didn't plant, they didn't harvest, they didn't do anything to prepare the fields. They're going to eat someone else's bounty. And God says, when you get there, remember that. My manna will cease. I will provide for you in a new way. It's going to be different, and you're to remember that and offer sacrifices to me as a reminder of what I've done and what I'm going to do and how I'm going to provide for you when I get there. Okay, so the rest of this chapter, again, is a reminder of the priesthood and all those things that are required now of the younger generation. Okay, now in 37, we get a ditty on the law that we've never seen before. It's unique to kind of this portion of Scripture. Read this. This is just an odd aside in the text.
Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel. Tell them to take tassels on the corners of their garments throughout all the generations and to put a blue thread in the tassel of the corners. And you shall have the tassel, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them. And that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined, and that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy for your God.
All right, so God gives them this basically like dress code, right? Speak to the sons of Israel, verse 38, tell them they shall put for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, that they shall put tassels of each corner of blue. Okay, so God literally gives them a dress code. Okay, this is called a tallit, a prayer shawl. You've probably seen these. This is a very Hebrew thing. Okay, this is a typical garment that they would wear. And God literally instructs them as to how they're to dress. Okay, on the corners of your garment or the edges of your garment, you would put these tassels. And what are the tassels? What was the purpose of having, why would God have them, why does he care about this? According to verse 39 and 40. To remember, remember, don't forget, remember why I've told you this. Okay, each one of these, it's kind of hard to see from back there. The tassels on the ends of the garments would be longer on mine and on most garments. There are 5 knots, okay? In between the knots, there are kind of a woven cord in between them. So the 5 knots would symbolize the 5 books of the Torah, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It would symbolize the Torah and God's law for them. In between these two are 4, obviously, spaces between the 5 knots. That would symbolize the name of God, Yahweh, okay, the four-letter word of God. Okay, and all of this was to serve as a reminder to the people. It was a tactile way for them to pray and to remind themselves, I need to be obedient to the word of God, which God has given me in the law. And instead of responding, do not follow after your own heart or your own eyes, follow after these things that you can see with your eyes. So, today, when you go to Israel, you will see Torah observant Jews wear these, okay? Often around like this, okay? And they would wear them when they pray. They'll wear them around their waist. They'll put like a dress coat or a blazer over it, and you'll see underneath their suit or whatever, these tassels kind of hanging out. It's this odd thing, okay? They'll use them. They'll pray with them. They'll put them over their heads. They do all kinds of sorts of things with them. But this is a typical tallit or a prayer shawl, okay? And then God uses kind of this other language that is not necessarily important for us, but there is one that is important, okay? This garment, the end of the garment, this corner, is called a kanaf in Israel, okay? In the Hebrew text, that's the Hebrew word kanaf, and these tassels are called tzitzit, okay? T-S-I-S-I, it's not super important, okay? The word kanaf, however, it's translated in our Bible, both corner, as you can see, but it's also translated wing, okay? W-I-N-G. Can you see why a kanaf would be translated as the word wings, Okay, so when you wear it like that, it would be seen that way. Okay, in fact, in the book of Psalms, it's talked about in that way. That same word that's used here for corner, kanaf, is translated in Psalm 17 as wing. Turn now, I want to show you just a couple things that are kind of cool, and there's a connection as to why I'm showing you this. In Malachi chapter 4, turn there, okay? And I want to show you what God says about the Messiah. Several believe this is a messianic text. Malachi 4, again, this is the last hurrah, if you will, of the Old Testament, the last book that we see 400 years before John the Baptist comes on the scene. The book of Malachi is written, okay? Chapter 4, verse 1. Pick up there.
For behold, the day is coming, burning like an oven, and all the proud, yes, all who are wicked will be stubble. And the day which is coming shall burn them up.
Okay, so 4:1 is talking about basically the consequences of disobedience, okay, of unbelief. However, verse 2, but for you who fear my name, those that believe who I am, that I am Yahweh, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healings in its, what's your word?
Wings.
Kanaf, okay? And you will go forth and skip about like calves in the stalk. And he's talking about now the blessings of obedience. You will tread down the wicked, verse 3. There'll be ashes under your soles of your feet, okay? But the idea is there was this sense that the Son of Righteousness, okay, it's S-U-N, not S-O-N. So some people just take this to mean like it's a picture of like a sunrise, and as God is the you know, just equating himself or comparing himself to the sun, and that there would be power in that or what have you. Some people believe that this is actually a messianic statement, that the Son, S-O-N, of righteousness will come with healing in his wings, in his kanaf, that he would have healing, okay? It's debatable. Calvin and Luther took this messianic stance. There are many other great theologians that say this has nothing to do with the Messiah, nothing to do with Jesus, okay? However, there's an individual in our New Testament that I think sees it the former way, that sees this as messianic, okay? Turn real quick to Mark chapter 5 or 8. I think it's 8. Hold on. Mark 5, verse 25. Okay, this is just a cool... Again, this is why you study your Old Testament, okay? 5:25. We got the story of a sick woman. Okay, beautiful story. Somebody pick up in 5:25.
There was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better but rather grew worse. She had heard.
Okay, stop right there for just a second. Okay, so you got this woman who has a hemorrhage. She has some type of bleeding disorder, probably of the female kind, just to be blunt. Okay, for 12 years she's had this. Now, based on what we've read in the law, what would that do to this woman? She's unclean for 12 years, which means what? She's cast out. Okay. Can she go to worship? Nope. So she can't go participate in church. She can't come to, you know, Sunday night and hear Brad speak. She can't hang out in her life group, right? She can't commune with God or the people of God in the same way that everybody else can. For how long? 12 years. You think you're a little bit tired of that condition? Like whipped. And what does Mark have to say about the physicians during that day and how much they've helped? Like zero, in fact, worse. This book, by the way, the story is recorded in the Gospel of Luke. Luke was a physician. Luke leaves this portion out, so he doesn't share. Oh, yeah, wait a second. So anyway, Luke shares the same story, but not the part about how physicians made her worse, right? So she's in a horrible condition, has been there for a long time, endured much pain, okay? After hearing about Jesus, verse 27, somebody pick up there. And touched his garment. Is that yours? How yours translates? Who has a different translation of what she touched?
His cloak.
The cloak. The what? The kanaf, more than likely. In Luke, sorry, it's not here. 8. Demons. Go to Luke chapter 8, verse 44. This is the same story, okay? Jesus returned, he's healing the people. Verse 43, a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and could not be healed by anyone came up behind him, 844, and touched what? The what? The fringe of his cloak, specifically, right? So this gal touches the fringe of his cloak, right? The corner of his cloak. Why would she touch that? Yeah, probably because she had seen or heard of Malachi 4 and said, the Son of Righteousness will come with what? Healing in his wings, healing in his kanaf. So what does she touch? His kanaf. So what is this action state about who she believes Jesus to be? I think this dude's the Messiah. I think this guy is the promised Old Testament Messiah, and if he is, then I can demonstrate that and know that for sure. How? By touching his cloak. That's all I have to. I don't even have to talk to him. I don't have to have him pray over. I can touch his cloak, and what will happen? I'll be healed. Continuing the story. Stay in Luke or whatever one. Luke 8:45. I'm sorry, by the way, what happened at the end of verse 44?
She's healed.
By the way, yeah, we should probably talk about that. That's a climax of the story. She's healed, miraculously, immediately, she's healed. So her hemorrhage stops. 45. Which is odd. They're in a crowd, right? So, like, Jesus, everybody's touching. You're in a crowd, but he takes notice of this moment. Like, someone touches him, and he realizes, wait a second, something just happened. So, why or how, I don't know. And Peter basically says, Master, the people are crowding around you and pressing in on you. Like, everybody's touching you. This is a mosh pit, right? 46, keep going, Cass.
But Jesus said, someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out of me.
Just kind of a weird statement. I perceive that power has gone out of me. Okay, keep going.
And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed.
So what do you think she's talking about in verse 47? It says in Numbers 15 this, it says in Malachi 1 this, and I think, or Malachi 4 verse 1 and 2 this, and I think that this guy is this guy. I think this dude's the Messiah, that's why I touched you. I mean, that's insane. While she's on her face, now in a posture that demonstrates who she thinks Jesus is, and watch Jesus' response in verse 48 as to what he believes that she believes.
And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace.
Wow. Your what? Your belief that I am the promised Messiah, and you clearly demonstrated that by what? Touching the fringes of my cloak. You really thought that I'm the Messiah, and what happened? Immediately healed. Okay, so just a cool connection to the New Testament as to why she did what she did. This gal knows her Bible. She's read her Old Testament. She knows Numbers, right? Some obscure passage in Numbers 15:37, which I'm sure all of you had memorized prior to this morning, right? In Malachi 4. And she knows it, and she had been expecting this. And God had put her in a situation that she had waited for 12 years to have that happen. So anyway, kind of a cool aside. So sometimes we read stuff and go, why is that there? Well, for this gal, it was life-changing. That is her favorite text. Okay, so back to the book of Numbers. So anyway, when you go to Israel, these are a great souvenir, by the way, as well. Or you can get them for a quarter of the price on eBay. It's true. Sorry. But they're not authentic. They're from China. So are the ones in Israel, but that's okay. All right, number 16. Now, again, back to the story of disobedience, back to the story of the grumbling. This is where it all escalates. This is the climax of that story. This is where it all comes to a crescendo. 16 verse 1. Pick up there.
Now, Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan, the Abram, the son of Eliab, and one of the sons of Heleth, the son of Reuben, who took men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown.
All right, stop there. So 16:1, there should be bells and whistles going off. Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, who would have been a Kohathite. Who are the Kohathites? We read about them with the Girgashites and the Merarites, however you say their name. What were those dudes? Yeah, they had, specifically, what family are they in? What tribe are they in? Levi, and the Kohathites had what job? Wasn't the tent, not the covers. They got to carry the Ark of the Covenant, all the utensils for worship. They had a rad job in Israel, okay? So they had arguably one of the coolest responsibilities of anyone else in Israel, okay? So Korah, one of the Kohathites, rallies with him, Levi, Dathan, Abiram, all these leaders, 250 dudes, not just like, you know, random hanyaks on the edge of the camp. Who does he take? Who are these other 250 guys?
Men of renown.
Men of renown. Mine says that as well as leaders. These guys are heads of families. These are dads that are in charge of a clan. So he's leading a coup, a rebellion against Moses. That's what's coming. So, and Korah is the guy that's kind of instigated this, and he's rallied now everybody to his side. So this is an ugly day, okay? Now, verse 3, here is their beef with Moses.
They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?"
All right, put that in Living Bible for me. What are they saying? It's a lot there. Why do you exalt yourself? You think you're better than everybody else, right? How do you think Moses took that? How'd that feel? It sting a little bit? You remember the guy who didn't want this job to begin with? He said, "Lord, uh-uh." Gave him four excuses and said, "You got the wrong guy. Pick somebody else. I can't speak. You know, I stutter, whatever. I got an eye twitch. I'm not the guy. I don't want this job." And God says, "No, you're going to go. And I'll give you your whoopee, Aaron, but you're going to be my guy." He's had this whole time this incredibly humble attitude, right? He even wrote about it. He's the most humble guy in the whole earth, right? Remember that? He genuinely is, though, right? This would have been a painful accusation because it's the one thing that he has sought to clearly say, I don't want this role. I'm not yearning for that. This isn't my goal. And he's having to fight the very thing that he's being accused of is the thing that's most precious to him, which is, I'm not exalting myself. God put me here. It is, right? So they say, you're exalting yourself. What else is in there? All the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. What does that mean? Speaking specifically to Moses and Aaron. Okay. Unpack that some more. What's Aaron's job?
I think they're saying that, like, well, we don't need you guys as priests to, like, intercede for us because God's here amongst all of us. We're all holy and, like, we have access to him.
Bingo. You get it? We don't need you. Your job is useless. Why do we need this go-between? Why do we need a mediator on our behalf? We're all holy. We're all set aside, set apart, right? We can go directly to God. We don't need you to do that. Wow, could you say anything more offensive to Moses and God? How do they feel about God's holiness and their lack thereof? They're oblivious to the fact that God is holy and they are not. Did we not just spend like 11 through 15 of Leviticus beating down the idea that you are unclean? God is clean and holy and separate, right? This is an arrogant, complete misunderstanding of who they are and who God is. It's offensive to Moses, and it's even more offensive to God. Do you see what these guys are saying in two verses? This is amazing. And this isn't, again, just the people on the outskirts. These are the leaders saying, "Moses, we have no need for you. We can go directly to God. We're good. Thank you. Time well served. Go sit on the bench." Okay? So Moses says, okay. 16 verse 3. I'm sorry, verse 4.
So then Moses heard it. He fell on his face and he spoke to Koah and his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is he and who is holy, and he will cause him to come near him. That one who he chooses, he will cause to come near him."
All right, so let's let's figure out tomorrow who is indeed holy and separated and set apart and who is not. And God will let God choose. Okay, notice verse 5. The Lord, his, himself, he, like, great. I'm going to stay out of this. We'll let God decide. This will be God's doing. And here's Moses. Here's his advice. Here's what we're going to do in verse 6.
Do this. Take censers, Korah, and all your company.
What were censers? You guys remember? Remember the big golden shovel, right? That you would take the offering from the altar and the ashes, you'd scoop it up, and then you would take it to the incense offering, put your fragrance on that. That's what would cause the beautiful smell. This was the role of the priest in the temple. So take your priestly instrument, act as priest, you 250, and Korah and Reuben and all you guys, and you're going to take censers and act like priests, and you're going to do the priestly thing, okay? Verse 7, put fire on them. Lay incense on them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow, and the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. Okay, so great. You take your 250 and you do that. And by the way, we're going to do the same thing. So it'll be a priest off. We're going to have you 250 against me and Aaron. Okay, and that's what we'll do. So we're outnumbered. That's fine. God will show you. Now, here is the thing that I think there's kind of a really cool application in the midst of this, specifically with Korah and I think to us as well. Okay. Moses in verse 7 says, you have gone far enough, you sons of Levi, right? I don't know what sons of he was thinking of, but he stops and says Levi, so I think that was good. Sons of Levi. Okay, verse 8. That's a bad English joke, sorry. Verse 8, Moses now says to Korah, hear this, you sons of Levi. There he said it again. So you just want to say, sons of Levi. Is it not enough? Listen to this. This had to sting. Is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand and minister before the congregation to them. And then he has brought you near, Korah, and all your brothers, you sons of Levi, with you. Are you not seeking the priesthood also? What is Moses saying to them? What job did they have? Specifically, just the sons of Korah. You get to carry the ark. You have one of the coolest and most revered and respected and renowned roles in all of Israel. And what does he say to them? Is that not enough? Like, you're number two amongst millions of people. And all you can look at is what? What you don't have. The role that God hasn't given you. And now you're seeking for, what does he say in verse 10?
Priesthood.
What does that mean? Who's the priesthood? Who's the head priest? Aaron. You want his job, right? I taught this years ago, and really I think the Lord kind of taught it to me in the midst of my own journeys. But this was a great lesson for me about being a number two. Not tongue-in-cheek, literally a number two guy, right? All of us serve in organizations where there's somebody over us and somebody under us, okay? Regardless of where you fit on the totem pole of the org chart, that's always the case, right? There are always people that have jobs that are over you, as overseers, as bosses, call them whatever you want, right? That their jobs may appear more cush or whatever, even if you're the CEO of an organization, right? Whoever it is, you've got a board to answer to. Nobody is without some type of accountability or what have you, okay? And then there's people that are underneath you, right? And the tendency on that totem pole of life is to look which way? Up and say, man, all I have is not enough. If I just had that role, that job, that whatever, my life would be better, right? And I found myself in a season in church ministry thinking about those things. Yeah, like all the stuff that I get to do is cool and that's great and all, but what I really want to do is what that person above me gets to do, and my life would be oh so much better if I could have that job, right? And that's basically what Korah's saying, right? And that applies to all of us in the midst of the organizations that we're in. And there's nothing wrong, again, with moving upward and using your gifts and your talents and what have you. That's a different conversation for a different day. These guys were barking and complaining, having a position that everyone else beneath them would have said, wow, that job is super cool. We have a ton of respect for you guys. God has given you this amazing job that you get to do. Holy cow, we would be blessed to be able to do what you do, and they are grumbling and complaining in the midst of it. It had to be offensive to the people below them that they would sneer and sniff at their job, thinking any of these people would jump in a second and do what they do, right? They had a respect for the priesthood that God had instilled in them, right? Because instead of taking every firstborn, they just took the Levites. So there was this picture of, man, we love you guys. We love what you guys get to do. It's cool. And you're complaining about it. And all you want is Aaron and Moses' job, right? This is offensive. So for us, I think there's a great application of what it looks like to be a great number two in an org chart, right? Because all of us at some point are going to live in that world. How do we support those that are above us, not envy the specific tasks that maybe God has called them to do? There are certainly things that Moses and Aaron get to do that they don't get to do, right? They don't get to kill the sacrificial lamb on Passover. They don't get to minister before the priest. They don't get to do certain things. It's not because they're less than. It's just simply that is not their role that God has for them, okay? But they could not handle that, and now they rebel, all right? And here's what's coming. So that's setting the table for you, okay? And Moses kind of kicks him in the gut and tells him very clearly, you're exalting yourself. You're accusing me of trying to move myself up the totem pole and be the representative. It's actually you who are seeking the priesthood. It's not me. Okay, verse 11, keep going.
Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. And what is Aaron that you complain against him? And Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the son of Eleb. But they said, we will not come up.
I mean, even in defiance, these were the guys that were mentioned in 16:1. Moses is calling them out as part of the rebellion. They're like, no, we're going to stay in our tents. You're not even worth our time, Moses, to come when you're summoned. Like, gosh, the arrogance and they're just so angry, right? And so disrespectful of Moses, okay? Verse 13, is it not enough? This is their response, the rest of the grumblers. Listen to what they say and what they're focused on. This is fascinating. It's a great litmus test for what we're focusing on, and you can kind of tell very quickly if you're in distress in your current place of employment. Is it not enough, Moses, that you have brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us? What are they saying is the land of milk and honey, by the way?
Egypt.
Wow. Gosh, could you use more offensive words, right? You're calling the promised land Egypt, the land flowing with milk and honey. You brought us out into this horrible place to die. Indeed, you have not brought us into the land flowing with milk and honey. You have not given us an inheritance, in verse 14, of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? Will you not come up? They're just solely focused on what Moses has not done. Here are all the things you promised that you haven't delivered on in the past, right? Oh, it was such great times when we were living by pots of meat, the land flowing with milk and honey. Egypt was great. We just want to go back. So Moses, in verse 15, rightly becomes very angry and said, do not regard their offering. This is him speaking to God. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done any harm to them. What does that mean when Moses says to God, do not have regard for their offering? Don't listen to them. If you bring an offering for sin and God does not accept it, who now is bearing that sin? The offerer, because it's not forgiven. So what is Moses basically saying? Don't forgive them, which means what? They're going to die. They have sin on them. Don't forgive their sin. I'm done with them. So Moses is at a different point now with these guys, okay? And it's come to this, and they've asked for it, so they're going to get it, okay? Moses continues to speak to Korah and tell him what's going to happen. Verse 16, come tomorrow. Verse 17, take your fire pan with your incense. You, verse 17, 250, and Aaron will bring his fire pan. So, and I'm obviously on Aaron's team. So it's you 250 against us. Each of them took their own incense with, in verse 18, with their fire on it, stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Okay. Verse 19, Korah assembled and all the congregation against him at the doorway of the tent of meeting in verse 19. And then God speaks now in verse 20. Pick up there. So what does God say? These 250 that are acting as priests, you may want to back up because I'm going to consume them like quick, fast, in a hurry right now. Look at Moses' response. This is unbelievable.
And they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and will you be angry with all the congregation?
What's Moses' response to God? What is he saying? Have mercy. If one man sins, who is Moses speaking of? Korah. If Korah sins, are you going to take it out on the whole congregation, right? He's trying to point the finger to Korah, who is, in some sense, the the head honcho of this. He's leading the coup, but all these guys that came with him also have sin in their hearts. They're in the same place. The Lord spoke to Moses in verse 24. Pick up there, Cass.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say to the congregation, get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram.
Abiram, yeah. So he says, everybody get back. That's God's answer. So yes, it's not just about Korah. It's about everybody. And here's what's going to happen. Verse 26, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing that belongs to them, or you will be swept away in their sin. Verse 27, everybody gets back with their wives and their little ones. And in verse 28, Moses is about to pull a Babe Ruth. He's going to call a shot, and he's going to say, we're going to know for sure that God is behind this, and God is favoring Aaron and not you guys by this sign. Okay? Verse 28, pick up there.
Moses said, hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord. If these men die as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me.
What does that mean? Yeah, if they just die naturally or die in a way that God's even killed people before through plagues or whatever, it's not from God. However,
but if the Lord creates something new and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them and they go down alive into
Sheol,
then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord.
All right, have we seen anybody in the history of our Bible die by God opening up the earth and it's swallowing them and closing it back up? Never, right? So Moses is like out of left field. Well, I'll tell you what. What have we not seen before? We've seen fireballs from heaven with Sodom and Gomorrah. We've seen, right? We've seen, a ginormous rainstorm and a flood. What if God just opened up the earth miraculously and all the bad people fell in and then God closed it up? If they die that way, then you're going to know it's not about me. It's about God and his righteousness and his holiness, and he's ticked with these people. So Moses calls this out of left field, okay? So what do you think is about to happen? Here's what's coming, right? They know exactly what's going to go on. 31, pick it up there.
And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households, and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods.
Are you kidding me? Like, as he finished speaking, the oath? Can you imagine standing there and seeing this? Like, these rebellious people waving their fists in the air with censers in their hands saying, this is what we're going to do. And Moses says, hey, just to be clear that this isn't about me, this is about your sin, God's going to open up the ground. It's exactly what he does. And notice, by the way, who else goes in. The earth swallowed them up in verse 32, and their households. Who would their households have been?
Wives and kids.
So fathers, are you responsible for your home? You bet you are. Were those kids in sin? Nope. Was your wife? Not necessarily. Did they die? Yep, they did. It's a rough story, okay? All that belonged to them went down to Sheol alive. Verse 33, the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. Are you kidding me? So amazing display of God's wrath, his miracles, okay? All Israel who were around them fled for the outcry. In verse 34, the earth may swallow us up. Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were with them offering incense. So in the midst of their religious priestly duties, how does God take care of the other 250 that are in complete disobedience? Fireballs from heaven. So this one we've seen before. So what is God trying to communicate by doing what he's doing? Is he just being angry at this point? What was Korah's beef with Moses to begin with? All the congregation is holy. We don't need an intercessor. We don't need a mediator. We don't need a Messiah. We're good with God. God's good with us. Okay? Go play the role of the priest. Go to him directly, tainted with your sin, and let's see what happens. And what does God do? He kills them because they do not understand God's holiness and their lack thereof and their need for a mediator, right? This isn't about Moses. This is about sin and God's view on it. Like kind of setting them up, you mean? That Moses kind of orchestrated that?
Well, I mean, like isn't that a fault of Moses also? That's kind of like what I'm thinking. Like.
Yeah. This wouldn't have been profane. This would have been do everything correctly, mm-hmm. Do it as Aaron would do it. So you're just going to play the role of Aaron. Exactly the priestly duties that he does. same incense, same offering, you're going to play that role. And let's see who God chooses. So he wasn't saying, like with Nadab and Abihu, mix it wrong or get hammered while you're doing it. So in that sense, it wasn't profane. It was a true, look, you're doing everything right. Aaron's doing everything right. Let's see who God chooses. So I think that's the lesson. It's not on Aaron or not on Moses. Okay. So those 250 are consumed in verse 35. Now, this is fascinating in verse 37. Pick up there. This is God now speaking to Moses in verse 36, says this in verse 37. Okay, so the incense, the censers that they were using, that they got killed with, as they're in their hand, he takes them, and in 38, watch what they do with these.
As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, for they offered them before the Lord, and they became holy. Thus they shall be a sign to the people of Israel.
So what do they do? What do they do with these censers? Yeah, they plated the altar with it, right? And what was the purpose of that? You got a gold-plated altar now. Why? It's a sign that 250 people tried to play the role of a priest that God had appointed specifically. And how did that go? Not so good. So when you go into the temple or the tabernacle and you see that altar, you're to call to be remembered, regardless of who you think you are and what you think about your stature before God, he is holy, and you are not. And 250-plus men thought more of themselves than they ought, and what happened? They died because of their sin that God did not forgive because they didn't handle this mediator thing correctly. Okay, we're going to see a king coming up after Solomon in the divided kingdom that forgets this lesson. And he's going to see these same plates that are on the same altar, and he's going to choose the route of Korah. And we'll see what God does to this guy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Like, there are still people that know that they descended from Aaron.
Yes, absolutely. That's a big deal in Israel because of obviously the lines and the families. So, yep. I met a good friend of mine in college, Carrie Corum is her name. Her dad's name was Danny Corum. He was a completed Jew. So, Jewish birthright and history, and yet became a Christian. He could trace his lines back to the sons of Korah. So, like, he was a Kohathite. So, like, he reads the text as an American, right? And is like, that's my family. I'm in here. Can you imagine reading scripture like that? Saying that ding dong was like my great, great, whatever. But yes, they would, and they do. So not everybody, but it's very important to, Torah observant Jews. They know that, and they can tell you what line they're from.
So not all the Kohathites died?
No, just these guys. The ones that were a part of the rebellion. So specifically Korah, the head of that family. What happens, by the way, if all the Kohathites die? We got a bigger problem, right? Who's going to move the ark? Oh, dang it. Nobody. So, yeah, it's just those guys. Okay? So, that is laid on the altar as a reminder. Now, what would you expect the response from the people to be at this point? Yeah, maybe to like go, oh, that was dumb. Okay? See also verse 41. Whoa. What? Whose fault is this? Moses, this is your fault. Like, are you with me? Like, you talk about a lesson and missing the point. These guys are completely ignorant of what's happening here. They completely don't see what's going on. They blame Moses. I mean, the whole point of this lesson was to say what? It's not about Moses. It's about God and who he chooses. He's picked Aaron to intercede on your behalf. You are not all holy. Neither is Aaron, by the way. But I picked him. He's my guy. And what do they say? No, Moses, this is your fault. Is it my sin? No. Is it my lack of holiness? No, this is your fault. So they're still, even in this moment, pointing fingers and playing the blame game. Unbelievable. Keep going. So now God's going to show up, and he ain't going to ask questions. He's just going to act at this point. Okay, keep rolling.
And Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from the midst of this congregation, and I may consume them in a moment. And they fell on their faces, and Moses said to Aaron,
all right, so God's basically starting a plague that is going to start at the center of the congregation, and spread outward. Okay? And he says, I'm going to consume all of them. And doesn't ask for Moses' or Aaron's opinion. He just does it. Now watch. This is fascinating. The get it factor with Moses is insane. Verse 46.
Moses said to Aaron, take your censer and put fire on it from off the altar and lay incense on it and carry it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun.
So what's the picture here? What does Moses command Aaron to do? To basically to perform his priestly duties. But what's the picture? He's taking a censer from where? The altar, which had what on it? An animal that was offered for sin. He's putting the ashes of that animal on the censer. Then he's taking it and putting the correct perfume mixture that was given to us in Exodus, whatever. And then he's having Aaron run out of the tabernacle where he has just convened with God to do what? To check the plague. So like, this plague is going out and Aaron is running after it as people literally are just dying. What does Aaron, or what does Moses realize about what power the priest has? Like, what's the picture here? What has there been? What is represented in his hand? Atonement. You have forgiven them. And if I can cover these people with the shed blood of an animal, God, in the system that you have orchestrated, there is forgiveness. You will overlook their sin. You will forgive them. You will atone for them. And in the midst of the fact that Moses would even consider that as an option, given the like just high-handed rebellion and offense that the people have offered to Moses, what is he still concerned about? The people. Isn't he an amazing leader? Do you not love this guy yet? I mean, he's amazing that he would say, Aaron, go atone for the people. Go take care of them. Go minister to them. That is our job. We are under shepherds. We are servants, right, to these people. That's our role. So Aaron literally is running out in the midst of just death falling around them, trying to meet the plague and check it with the shed blood of an animal, right? Keep going, Cass. Where'd you end up? Those who died in the affair of Korah. 14,000 people die. And like as fast as Aaron is running, as fast as he can, Aaron returned to Moses to the door of the tent of meeting, and the plague had been checked. I mean, what a story, right? And how do you think the reaction of this people is going to be after Aaron just saves all of their lives? They're still hard-hearted. They still don't get it. They're still not grateful. They still don't get their own sin. What would you do at this point if you're God? What do you do? You're great. You don't want me? You don't want my blessing? You don't want my land? You don't want to walk with me? Okay. This is what you want? You want to die in the desert? Okay. Your hearts are hard and you will not turn. Okay. I will allow you to stay in your hardness of heart and die in disobedience. Man, like what a... Hebrews calls this a rebellious and disobedient generation. Like that's how they're pictured later in the New Testament. The whole generation, right? And there obviously were exceptions to that. Caleb and Joshua, thank you, that are not characterized by that. But boy, as a whole, these guys are just hard-hearted. So I don't know what else God could do, but this is where he's at, okay? So hard climax of this story. This, by the way, started with what in chapter 11? A couple people going, what happens every time with grumbling? It's a cancer, okay? So as you guys think through that again, this chapter 16 is directly related to a few people who barked about a situation that they didn't like. Instead of handling it properly, going to leadership, talking it through, expressing concerns, not barking about it behind the scenes. And man, I am guilty of that too in my own roles, both on a church staff and as my organization that I get to run. I'm guilty of this too, but it's a great reminder for all of us what happens when people bark and complain. Okay, so as little power as sometimes we feel like we have as underlings, boy, we can sure cause a brush fire fast if we're not careful with how we handle our words and our actions. Okay, so 17, just in case you missed the lesson, God's going to show us one more time who his chosen lineage is. He's going to reestablish the Aaronic, the Aaron's priesthood, if you will. Okay? Verse 2, this is the command now he gives to all the sons of Israel.
Speak to the children of Israel and get them and get from them a rod from each of the father's house, all their leaders according to their father's house.
All right, so they're all going to get a rod or a staff. Okay, like Aaron's rod, they're all going to take a staff. Write Aaron's name in verse 3 on it for the tribe of Levi, and each one a rod for the head of their father's household. So you're going to have Judah and Ephraim and Manasseh, all the rods. You're going to have 13 of them lined up, okay? You shall then deposit them in verse 4 at the doorway of the tent of meeting, okay? I will come about and I will choose a rod. So God's going to now go choose which one is his. Which one do you think it'll be? Levi's, right? Aaron's rod. And we're going to know that because verse 8.
Now on the next day, Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds.
So overnight, we go from an almond plant to a ripe almond. They were put on every rod, and the only one that bloomed was Aaron's. Overnight. That is a miracle. You don't get ripe almonds in a day, right? Farmers would lose their minds if they could do that, and it would be making gazillions of dollars, right? So it's a miracle saying, this is the one I picked. The rest of them do not get chosen. So we've got ripe almonds overnight, okay? Put back the verse 10, the rod of Aaron before the testimony, and keep it as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me so that they will not die. So God, or Aaron, and Moses take now that rod, place it in the ark in the tent of meeting with the manna, and Aaron's now rod and the broken Ten Commandments. And that is the picture that God has chosen. Okay, verse 12, watch now the response of the people.
Then the sons of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, behold, we perish, we are dying, we are all dying. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Are we to perish completely?
We're dying. We're bad. Life is tough. Like this. Are you not blown away by the congregation and just their lack of? There's no repentance. There's no understanding. It's all about them, right? We are dying. Life is hard. We're all going to perish. Insane that they just completely swing and miss on all of this. So you see again, kind of the conclusion of this piece, and God's now going to continue to reestablish who He is in the priesthood. But these people just don't get it. And Moses continues to respond in amazing leadership and amazing godliness throughout. So let's tie a bow on that. Any thoughts on this before we conclude? Do you guys love Moses yet? I hope you do.
I thought it was cool that Moses still relies on Aaron to do the priestly duties.
Yeah. That have been tempting to step in there. Yeah, right. He gets the order and realizes that's not God's role for me. Even as the leader of the people, I'm not the priest. Aaron is. That's a good call. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just seemed like a very messianic thing in Aaron. Like what it says, he's standing in between the living and the dead.
Yeah.
The sacrifice.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's, you see the role of a mediator, right? And that is the, in essence, the Messiah, the one that bridges the gap between the sinful and the sinless. That's Aaron's role. It's a beautiful picture. And you get to see it in living color here when people physically die without the presence of a go-between. And that's, John talks about that, as we have a mediator, 1 John somewhere. But that's the beautiful picture of the Messiah. It's a good call. Any other thoughts? All right. Well, bless you guys. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll continue this and roll through some more numbers.